The PFD application is open. Just a small amount of your PFD will help share local news and stories about Alaskans with Alaskans across this great state when you choose Alaska Public Media through Pick, Click, Give.
Coming up on Hometown Alaska, we celebrate Women's History Month by showcasing some of the Alaska women who were honored at the 2026 Athena Awards. Host Dave Waldron sits down with the founder of the Anchorage chapter of the Athena Society and this year's Leadership Award winner, Dr. Ann Zink. And on State of Art, we'll hear about Anchorage Community Theater's Marvel. Join me, Ammon Swenson, as I sit down with the playwright and director of the now completely sold-out run of shows about Alaska's first licensed female aviator. That's all coming up next on Hometown Alaska from Alaska Public Media.
Hi, I'm Avery Elfelt, a reporter with the Alaska Desk. That's a joint reporting effort from Alaska Public Media, KHNS, where I work in Haines, and other public radio stations in Anchorage, Fairbanks, and the Aleutians. It allows us to connect you with the issues happening in communities all across the state. You can hear our stories during the morning news on Alaska News Nightly or online at alaskapublic.org. The Alaska Desk is only possible with the support of grants and listeners like you. Thank you.
Hello and welcome to Hometown Alaska. I'm Dave Waldron, and today we're celebrating Women's History Month. And what better way to do that than to showcase some Alaskan women who just last week made history of themselves and were honored at the 2026 Athena Awards. The awards are given to only a select few Alaskan women that have shown professional excellence, commitment to community, and the leadership potential of women. Later on the show, I'll be speaking with Dr. Ann Zink, who is the sole recipient of the Athena Leadership Award, and we'll also hear from a few other Athena winners throughout the program. But right now, I'm happy to welcome Eleanor Andrews. She is the founder of the Anchorage Chapter Athena Society. Eleanor, welcome to Hometown Alaska.
Well, thank you. May I correct something?
You may.
I've tried for years to get people to not say winner. Athena is not a contest. It's a recognition, like you mentioned, of women who've had professional or business achievement, involve themselves in the community, and help other women along the way. That's one of the main features.
So not an award winner, but a recognized
recipient. Yes.
Okay, got it. Thank you for the clarification.
All right.
So Eleanor, the Athena Awards have been around for a while now, more than 40 years, but you started the Anchorage chapter about 10 years ago. So what inspired you to create this local chapter?
In 1989, it was started by a woman named Martha Mertz in Lansing, Michigan. And we had a person on the Anchorage Chamber Board named Joyce Murphy. She was an animal vet. I don't know what the word is, but she only did eyes.
Oh, okay.
And she was first recognized and then for years trying to get it going again. And right before she left the state, she resurrected with the chamber, and I was the first recipient in 1996. So I was surprised, but I was a business person. I'd received some other awards as a federal contractor, and I was on the board, and I was a likely. Because frankly, not that many people paid attention to women's achievement in business. So they knew me, and I was gratified to be recognized.
Well, that's very cool. Well, let's talk about some of the past inductees of the Athena Society. A lot of our listeners will recognize many of the names, like Senator Lisa Murkowski, Keegan Randall, and our very own Beattie Trantina, who spent almost 40 years here at Alaska Public Media and KSKA. What are some of the other recipients that you've been excited to see get recognized that maybe don't have the same name recognition, but are still doing good work?
You know, I'm a good old girl, so I remember Arla Sturgiluski.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Joe Mahalski, Sharon Richards, who is the wife of Elmo Sackett, Barb Cash. There's so many women who were my contemporaries. I kind of call them my posse, that I hadn't thought about other names, but I'll come up with a few in a minute.
And why was that so important for you to get this chapter going? Did you feel like a lot of people just weren't getting the proper recognition they deserved?
We didn't have a vehicle. Mm-hmm. You know, as I reflect to the beginning, there weren't a lot of women at the top of anything, or if they were in an organization, they weren't recognized as the leader or the playmaker or whatever. So one of the most gratifying things for me was helping identify women who were doing great things and giving them a showcase. And this luncheon thing that we'd have every year, it's just grown exponentially, and we keep finding more and more women who are being nominated, who are doing things that I thought I knew everything that I'd never heard about before.
Yeah, and you just hosted the 2026 recipients last week.
Yes, and March 16th.
How did it go?
It was fabulous. It was standing room only in the Captain Cook Ballroom. I've never seen a more joyous collection of women. Those who've been nominated or recognized, and those who are just glad to be in everyone's company. It was really wonderful.
You have a pretty impressive history yourself, Eleanor. As you mentioned, you're a past Athena recipient. Of course, we know that. But you mentioned Elmo Sackett a little bit earlier in the show. We're in his building right now talking.
Yes, I love driving up and seeing that on the sign.
Yeah. So what can you tell us about your early relationship with public media and Elmo Sackett?
Well, in the beginning, when we're building things, you know, I lived in Fairbanks first, and we had talk radio and selling things on the radio and messages from town to town. That's basically what we had for communications. We had one commercial TV station, and the programs are 3 weeks late. After you're here for a month, you kind of lost that you were 3 weeks behind because that's all you had. And Elmo was just a person that had foresight. And I was just in the company of all these, I call community builders, state builders, statesmen. And he had an idea. And then I was fortunate enough that when I worked for the state of Alaska and Department of Administration, public broadcasting was one of the programs I oversaw.
Oh, wow.
Okay. And so Charlie Northrup was the executive director. And he had a spidey sense. If he ever thought any legislator was going to take money away from public broadcasting, he'd show up at my office and he said, I heard so-and-so wants to cut the money for Kotzebue. I said, no. And back in those days, Department of Administration, through the legislature, funded 95% of the cost of all of public broadcasting. Those were the days.
Yeah, you know, I'm trying not to make this a show about public broadcasting.
Okay.
You're talking about these people fighting so hard to keep the funding for public broadcasting going. We know the state that we're in right now today.
Right.
But again, this is not the public broadcast show. This is the Athena recognition show. So, Eleanor, in honor of Women's History Month, is there anyone that you'd like to recognize for just your personal journey, some inspirations to you along the way? You've been involved in so much, it sounds like.
There's so many that I've already been involved with. When I look back on women maybe who were trailblazers or did things new or innovatively, I think about Jo Michalski and her sister Jana Hyinga, two women from Minnesota who came here and basically recreated local retail. They ended up owning four or five different stores, from quilting stores to bookstores to children's toy stores and women's clothing and crafts and things that tourists love to buy. And they're both retired now, one more recently than the other. And those were the days when women couldn't borrow a dime from a bank. Nobody would loan us any money. So they forged ahead, and I really think they were trailblazers for people in banking and finance to realize that women could make it in business. I think about Cynthia Parker, who started out in Bethel after having done her first work in Portland, and she brought a neighborhood housing to Alaska. And through that program in Anchorage, we developed over 1,200 units of affordable housing, either rehabbing old complexes are building brand new housing, which is now some of it's 30 years old, and is still the best in the city. Another is Barbara Cash. She and her husband were in architecture and design, and Barbara brought a level of professionalism and really classy work. And I got to the point, I love going to different offices around town, and I'd say, that's Barbara's look. And she mentored a lot of women. She mentored Michael Fredericks, who's also now in the Athena Society, and just provided a place where women could be seen, mentored, and grown. And that's what I love about the Athena program. Back in the day, when women first got into things, you could only be the one. They didn't want a whole bunch of women, just one. And so what we're able to do is open the doors, bring women up and in to be recognized and be the best that they could be in their business and professional life.
Just hearing these stories makes me think about how far our society has come, thankfully. You know, people aren't afraid to lend money to women for the most part, but we still have a long way to go, right? So how much further do we have to go until...
I think the first thing that needs to happen is that women need to recognize they already have all the chops. We make most of the money, and sometimes we don't want to step forward in a situation or even a relationship to show that we have the wherewithal to be in charge. So I think we need to go back a little bit to when we were pioneering and have everybody realize how far we've come. We shouldn't have to beg for recognition or credit worthiness. I was at a federal contractor level in my career, and my company was pretty new. We were earning about $4 million a year, and I couldn't get a bank loan. I could not get a loan to give me money to grow. I couldn't get an operating loan. And I just kept going and rearranging things and doing daily cash flow analysis. And one day, a banker came to my office, and he brought a leasing person, a person with operations experience, an insurance person. They said, we'd like to bank you. I said, really? I mean, this entourage shows up in my office. And I said, okay. We made all these deals, and for like the last 10 years of my business, I never had to go to the bank. They came to me, and I was flying to D.C. for a meeting, and there was a magazine on board called Lear's, and I was reading it, and the article was about private banking, and that's what I had. I didn't even know what it was called, and I didn't know guys got it, but I mean, I said, I've made it.
That's when you knew, huh?
It was very gratifying.
I bet. Well, Eleanor, you're probably not allowed to pick favorites, but have there been any moments in the past 10 years just for the Anchorage Athena chapter that have made you particularly happy to see someone get finally recognized for their hard work?
It's really difficult. I don't think I can do that because so many women are my contemporaries and they're all at the top in my eyes. Mm-hmm. You know, Ann Zink helped save Alaska's health. So when she was brought into the society a couple of years ago and then recognized on March 16th, there was a standing room only. Everybody stood up and applauded her because we recognized what she had done for the state in a very diplomatic way, dodging politics or whatever, but kept a lot of us alive. So for a recent recognition, I'd pick Anne. And the acceptance speech she gave was exceptional in that she had everybody else's story as part of her speech. Even Laurie Townsend recognizing her for what she's done in journalism through public broadcasting. It was just the most gratifying thing.
Yeah, we'd be remiss not to mention Laurie's name, of course. She was a 2026 winner herself, host of Talk of Alaska and longtime news editor for Alaska Public Media there.
Yes.
So what are some other things going on with the Athena Society that aren't the award ceremony?
One of the most important programs we started was a scholarship program for young women, girls, to go to business camp. At these camps, they are sponsored at universities, and the Chamber and Soroptimus and other organizations send them, and they learn about how to start a business, how to work with a partner, how to market it. And at the program, they present their business plan to local women businesses.
Oh, really?
And it's become very, very sophisticated. We've sent girls to Rutgers and Cornell and one time to Hawaii. But for the last couple of years, we've been sending them to a college in Oregon. And they've got a very organized, stratified program for business development. And it's just a wonderful thing to see these girls, 15 to 17, come in, pitch their ideas to us, go down there and develop their ideas and come back and make a presentation, and they're going to be the new leaders.
Eleanor, where would you like to see the Athena Society in the next 10 years? And is it going in the right direction? Are you liking the way things are looking?
I love the way it's going right now because there's so many people that volunteer, women that have been recognized or maybe don't even want to be, and they volunteer all year to put it together. We have people that volunteer and do all the data collection. We have women that put the luncheon together, people that do the advertising. What I'd love to see for Alaska, since I'm talking to you on Alaska Public Media, is it being created in more cities. About 15 years ago, I went to Kodiak, Fairbanks, Soldotna, Kenai, and Homer, and said, this is a program that you can do. You have a chamber of commerce. And at that time, I happened to talk to a woman who was chamber chair or in some hierarchy, and they loved it. And then when it got to their board, they thought, we don't want to do that. So my dream would be that Athena be statewide, not just Anchorage.
Got it. Yeah. And how does the recognition work? Do you nominate someone, I'm assuming, or are they recognized some way by the society?
Well, we've gotten to the point where we have a very organized way of doing it. We advertise, and basically a person may nominate herself or others nominate her, and there are three categories: her professional or business achievements, giving back in society and the community. What do you do? Kind of payback.
Right.
And then helping other women reach their highest level. And those are the three things that we judge them on. And, you know, we used to have 15, 20 nominees. Last year we had 44. And this year we had 57. And I said, I'm going to go blind if we get any more than that. Because there's a committee of people, all the former Athena recipients, the ones who got the annual recognition, and other volunteers. And we read every single one of them. And we spend time, you know, putting them all together and deciding who we can have come in this year. And we try to keep it to a limited number. Usually it's 10. This year we had 11. So it's difficult because there's so many achievers. And what I love is hearing about people that I didn't know and what they're doing.
Absolutely. And of course, it's too late to nominate someone for the 2026 award. When can they start nominating someone for 2027? Like today? is it too early?
No, it's more collapsed than that. I believe that the nominations start in February.
Okay.
January or February. And they come in and all the wonderful volunteers organize them. It's on a format that people that have a lot more technical skills than I do get it all organized. And then we sit down and start reading, taking notes and evaluating. Yeah. Can you imagine 57 nominations?
Yeah, you'll probably have 100 next year.
Like I said, I'm going to claim old and probably not do it anymore.
Well, there you go. I want to thank my guest, Eleanor Andrews. She is the founder of the Anchorage Chapter Athena Society, which just gave out their 2026 Athena recognitions last week. Thanks, Eleanor, for coming in and talking to me.
Thank you.
In just a moment, we'll be hearing from several of this year's inductees, including Dr. Ann Zink, who we were just talking about, who took home the Athena Leadership Award. I am Dave Waldron, and you're listening to Hometown Alaska on Alaska Public Media.
Let's hear from one of this year's Athena Society awardees. Dana Fabe was the first woman to serve on and lead the Alaska Supreme Court.
I came to Alaska actually right out of law school for a one-year adventure as a law clerk for the Alaska Supreme Court. I didn't assume that I would stay here. I actually had another job lined up in Boston, but I thought this would be a wonderful year after graduating from law school to have an adventure. I drove up myself, took the ferry up to Haines, and then drove the last 900 miles by myself. I was 25 years old, and with all my belongings in my car, which definitely didn't have enough clearance, and arrived actually almost exactly 50 years ago, in July of 1976. After clerking for the Alaska Supreme Court, I went on to become a baby public defender at the Alaska Public Defender Agency. Eventually, Governor Jay Hammond appointed me to be the chief public defender. From there, I went to the trial bench in Anchorage, the Superior Court trial bench, and I was appointed to the Alaska Supreme Court in 1996 and was the first woman to serve on the Alaska Supreme Court. I will quote Sandra Day O'Connor, at least paraphrase her, When asked about being appointed the first woman on the United States Supreme Court, she said she just wanted to make sure she wasn't the last. And I think that is the pressure. You want to do a good job and you want to represent well in your profession always, but in particular, being the first woman, I wanted to do a job where nobody could say, oh, she was just appointed because she was a woman and she didn't measure up. So yes, I think there is extra pressure. On the Alaska Supreme Court, although people think it's an isolating job, it is not, because you never are making a decision by yourself. You have your four colleagues in the room with you. And the interchange was intellectually exciting. Everybody was equally prepared and ready to discuss the nuances of a case. My colleagues were so incredibly welcoming to me when I joined the court as the first woman. I've loved every job I've had. I never actually was looking too far down the road. I think if somebody had said, you know, if you want to be on the Alaska Supreme Court, what should you take as your path? They wouldn't have particularly suggested mine. It wasn't linear. And I just took each job with the idea of doing something that I love to do. And that is, I think, when you love your work, how you perform well and get recognition. The other women who were also inducted into the Athena Society are an amazing group. I wasn't expecting the call, but being in the cohort of this year's class was truly an honor.
That was Dana Fabe, former Justice of the Alaska Supreme Court and a 2026 Athena Society awardee.
I'm Shelby Herbert, a reporter with the Alaska Desk. That's a joint reporting effort from Alaska Public Media and KUAC, where I work in Fairbanks, and other public radio stations in Anchorage, Haines, and the Aleutians. It allows us to connect you with the issues happening in communities all across the state. You can hear our stories during the morning news, Alaska News Nightly, or online at alaskapublic.org. The Alaska Desk is only possible with the support of grants and listeners like you. Thank you.
Welcome back to Hometown Alaska. I'm Dave Waldron, and today we're discussing the Athena Awards and their recipients. The yearly award is given out to women who have shown professional excellence, commitment to community, and the leadership potential of women. And speaking of leadership, I'm very happy to introduce my next guest and Athena Leadership Award recipient, Dr. Ann Zink. She's also an occasional host of Alaska Public Media's Line One, Your Health Connection here, and welcome to Hometown Alaska.
Great. It's so wonderful to be on this guest side. Thanks
for
having me.
Great to have you here on this side. So we're recording this immediately after the awards. Your lunch is probably still digesting. How did it go?
You know, it was a really fun event. It's fun to see Alaskans from different organizations, different communities connect together. And I think that's one of the things I really appreciate about Alaska is, you know, you're talking to someone who runs a clothing company, to someone else who's helping small businesses get started. You know, I spent a lot of my time in health, and it was really nice to just see everyone and see the excitement and supportive kind of camaraderie that you see. Keegan Randall was another one of the recipients, and, you know,
yeah,
it was fun to see all the young, you know, athletes getting excited to meet her and talk. And it was a huge honor. It was fun.
Yeah, a lot of great names in this class. So what was your reaction when you found out you were getting not only the award, but the one and only leadership award for the class of 2026?
Yeah, no, I was really humbled and surprised, honestly. You know, I'm a practicing emergency physician. I like to kind of be behind the scenes and help and bring the blankets to the patient's bedside and not necessarily front and center. And when I came to the state of Alaska, I was really interested in how do we decrease healthcare costs? How do we make it simpler for patients? And I took that job in July of 2019, right. Not in the future, 2019, not expecting a worldwide pandemic. And in that time was really kind of thrust into the limelight, trying to figure out how do we make sure we have resources to support Alaskans to make decisions for themselves and their family and their community to try to stay as healthy and well with this really new and novel virus that we were learning about on a daily basis. And I've kind of stepped back out of the limelight, and it's kind of been nice and quieter. So hearing that I was there, it was very kind, but it was, a little bit of a change for my everyday life nowadays.
Yeah, let's talk about that a little bit. So you probably weren't expecting a lot of things that were going to happen 1 year after you took the job in 2019 there. And you're probably our most famous chief medical officer that we've ever had because of this pandemic we were suddenly finding ourselves in. And all of a sudden, people are desperate for answers. They want to know what's going on and how to handle the situation. And they're probably looking to you for that. So what was that like? When did you first get wind of how serious the pandemic was going to be? And how stressful was that for you, not being someone that was used to the limelight, as you say?
Yeah, you know, it was really kind of in December of 2019, we started to hear rumors out of what was happening in China. My predecessor, Dr. Jay Butler, also a host of Line One, and he had stepped into the role as the deputy director of infectious disease at the CDC. Mm-hmm. And that was a huge advantage to myself as well as to the state of Alaska as a whole, because, you know, we had a very close connection and would talk regularly. So when I really realized it was going to be a huge challenge was the very first week of January. Jay and I went and climbed the butte out in Palmer. It was cold. It was like negative 20. And we went and got a cup of tea afterwards at Turkey Red. I'll never forget it. And he got a call and he said, I need to take this. And he was on the call and I could only hear his side of it. And he's like, that sounds bad. That sounds concerning. It sounds like this could be a coronavirus.
Oh.
Wow, I wonder if this could be a worldwide pandemic. So that was the first time I'd been hearing things, but to see Jay's face as he was actually learning about the first genomic sequences that were coming out and what they were hearing out of China was humbling, but also very helpful because it kind of helped me to realign how we need to be thinking about the job and the expectation and started to work very closely with the governor and others at that time. And also, as I think many Alaskans remember, we helped to repatriate that flight in January. And so we really stood up our emergency response in January of 2020. So much earlier than most other states. And I think that really helped us to just make sure different departments were connected and the ways that we were able to respond. And then after that, you know, I had this attending once say to me, and I talked about this today at the Athena Award, is he always said, you know, Anne, do what's right for patients and the rest is noise. And so really from that moment on, it was like, okay, what do I really think is the best that I can possibly think of for the health and well-being of Alaskans and really seeing Alaskans as my patients, not the people just in the emergency department on that shift
right.
as my patients. And so does that mean testing? Does that mean resources? Like, what do we have? What do we know? What do we don't know? And how can I try to align limited resources for the health and well-being of Alaskans?
Wow. Just crazy story just out there in the negative 20 degree weather on the butte, finding out about this pandemic. That's wild. I remember the videos you would often post online. Me and my wife watched all of them. I never thought I'd be like gathering around the phone, you know, on a regular basis. Like, we need to listen to the chief medical officer, like what she has to say. It was this bizarre time, you know. Did a lot of people reach out and thank you or let you know that you had become like this regular part of their life during that time?
Yeah, I think it still surprises me on a regular basis. You know, it's funny, the further we get from the pandemic, I run into people at the airport or other places and they'll say like, I think I know you. Like, do our kids, like, were they in school together? And I'm like, I'm not sure how I know you. So it's weird to have this kind of asynchronous relationship with people.
Yeah,
because
right.
I didn't see who was on the other end of that, you know, TV screen or on the other side of that video. But Alaskans have been incredibly kind and supportive. And like I just mentioned that at the Athena event here today, I mean, the greatest gift I was given working in the state of Alaska was working with Alaskans. And it was really about how can we get out of the way, because Alaskans know best on how to take care of their health, their well-being, their community. And if we can just share information, knowledge, resources as they come in and as we see and be humble about what we know and don't know, and not try to be the expert in the room, but just say, this is what we know, this is what we don't know. And yeah. Alaskans stood into that space in such remarkable, resilient ways that it was just a real gift to work with Alaskans across the state.
Yeah, and it seemed like a really clear line of communication that you had with them. And even though at the beginning there was this great window of time that we were all unified on the pandemic, you know, people were taking the COVID-19 seriously, we were all worried together, and we wanted to keep our neighbors and ourselves safe. Not long after, we had this issue going on where suddenly people are not wanting to wear masks, and then fast forward later, people don't want the vaccines, claiming they're unsafe for all kinds of reasons, some of them pretty far out there reasons, like the microchip trackers and stuff like that. So, I mean, how challenging was it for you to showcase the science of this virus and the vaccine to a population that was becoming kind of resistant to the scientific data?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's where I really rely on my experience in the emergency department. It's not my job to tell someone how they should treat their cancer or, you know, if we should give their kid Tylenol after, you know, they broke their arm or whatever. My job is to listen to them and hear their concerns. You know, I talked about this again at the award. I said, you know, I talked about five lessons I learned from the emergency department. But the first was like, listen to what's not being told. And oftentimes in the emergency department, I'm not only thinking about what might kill you or what's the most likely diagnosis, but I'm also trying to listen to what you're really afraid of or why you might be there. So, you know, my sister died of cancer, and so I'm worried this headache is that, or I'm worried this fever is going to cause a seizure. People have a fear that's oftentimes associated with their. And I found the same thing during COVID and the COVID pandemic when people didn't, you know, want to wear a mask or get vaccinated or stay at home. There was real valid concerns behind those concerns and reasons, and that maybe they had a bad adverse reaction to a vaccine previously. Maybe their child had autism and they didn't know. Maybe the medical system had failed them and they were in debt because they had gone in with a heart attack. There were a lot of reasons. And oftentimes being able to listen to what was unsaid, you would hear the deeper concern. And it really was very, very, very rarely about not wanting to keep community safe or not wanting to protect themselves or others, but it was something else. And I think by coming to it with the humility that each person is trying to do the absolute best they can to be well, healthy and well, and to care for their community, and to see that best intention of people, so often you could find common ground, insight, ways to partner, even though it may look different from a different community and partner. So I mean, there was challenges to it for sure. I think the hardest thing for me was then seeing patients in the emergency department really, really sick.
Right.
And they would say, my friends all got this and they were fine. And now I'm clearly not fine. And seeing some of those people die, seeing things that are potentially preventable kill people is the hardest thing. So that was the hard part for me, not the questioning. I actually really appreciated the questioning. I think it made us better. I think it made the team better. I think we always need to have space for really open, robust dialogue and questioning. But it's hard to see people suffer.
Absolutely. Well, Anne, I imagine you get kind of tired talking about COVID sometimes. People probably, when people are saying, where do I know you from? You probably think, I know where you know me from. So other than COVID-19, what are some other projects that you're part of in the medical community that people might not know about?
Yeah, thanks for asking about that. I mean, I actually like, you know, in the emergency department, you know, we care about infectious diseases, but they're actually a very small percentage of what we do. We deal with a lot of injuries. We deal with heart attacks. You know, we deal a lot with fractured systems. I oftentimes say patients are my why, but policy is my how. And I got into policy because I wanted to make systems better for patients so they didn't have to choose between going bankrupt or getting treated for their heart attack, that they had access to a primary care. That's why I chose it. So, you know, prior to coming to the state, spent a lot of time working on the opioid epidemic. And through a tremendous partnership in the Mat-Su Valley, you know, we decreased the opioids distributed from our department by 90% in 1 year, and what was given out of our emergency department by 70% in 3 years, while increasing our patient satisfaction. We saw decreased deaths out there. We built an organization that does complex care utilization. I was just talking to the director the other day, and you know, they're currently serving 273 Alaskans who are really falling through the cracks of the system, and on average, decreasing their emergency department visits by about 50% by being able to connect them to primary care, transportation. So really trying to figure out how systems can better serve people instead of people serving systems. I spent a lot of time on the data space trying to make sure that when a patient comes in and says, I take two white pills, I have some sense of what that is, or I don't have to rescan them after they've had an imaging someplace else.
Yeah.
Trying to make systems work better for people.
Well, March is Women's History Month as well, and you are an inspiring woman and you're now recognized leader, of course, with the Athena Award there. Who are some inspiring women to you?
That's a great question. You know, I think I would start with actually my eighth grade teacher.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. Kyle Redford was amazing. I think she really saw me as a person and let me be my own person. I still am in touch with her today. I still get great life advice from her. And
really?
Yeah,
that's
great. She was my history teacher. I didn't go into history at all, but I think I'd start with her. My mom was a trailblazer in her own right. She was one of the first women to climb Mount Logan. She became a doctor when women really didn't become physicians, and looking in that direction. I've got two daughters, and man, they challenge me and push me to grow every single day in super fun and interesting ways, and they're really inspiring. And then there's just a whole group of Alaskan women. You know, when I started at MATSU, there were no other female physicians in the emergency department, and this other woman, Megan Lindstrom, and I started together. And so we've been, you know, the two women together there. Mm-hmm. We now, the group is 50-50 or just about, but when we first started, it was just the two of us. And you know, people like Senator Murkowski willing to go for a hike and just talk about, like, you know, how do you try to figure out how to make these really complex bureaucratic systems work better for people in so many different ways. And I am late here because I got a ride from Commissioner Hedberg and Deputy Commissioner Ricci, who are two other really inspiring women, because my daughter had the car and they brought me over. So, you know, they are really working hard to make health and health systems better within the state.
Well, what are some other things you like to do, Anne? I mean, everyone knows you as Dr. Anne Zink. What are some of the things you like to do in your free time?
Yeah, you know, I was a mountaineering guide. That's why I came up to Alaska. My husband and I actually met in Palmer, Alaska, where we now live and practice. I worked for Knowles National Outdoor Leadership School, and loved the time in the outdoors. In our time here, we've been in Alaska now 18 years. I thought we would come up here for 2 or 3 years, but really fell in love with the community and fell in love with the place. So being out hiking or running on the trails, being connected to just an amazing group of men and women and kids and community members is a big part of my life. I talked about today, checked off a bucket list of mine. We got to go heli skiing in Valdez over spring break.
Really? Wow.
That was fantastic. So trying to get out. But it's just an amazing state. And I just... being able to like listen and learn and to connect to people and being able to be out in nature bring me a lot of joy.
Yeah, that's another thing I really liked about your videos that you would always release, is you always had this kind of positive finishing thought, and a lot of it had to do with doing what you can to still have fun and be positive in a time that was not a fun time. And that was like, go outside, you know?
Yeah.
You know, the pandemic, it's not stopping you from going outside. And I remember seeing a lot more people on the trails during that time and thinking, that's pretty cool that that's happening. Well, Anne, what's next for you right now? What do you have planned for the near future?
Yeah, so I'm still a practicing emergency medicine doc. I continue to practice throughout the entire time I worked at the state because I didn't want to give up my patients. So I still worked a few shifts a month. I still do that out of MATSU. I am part-time now at the Yale School of Public Health, all remotely. I don't go there, but I am teaching a class on what I wish I would have known. But more excitingly, I think I'm working on a project called Pop Hive. So as an emergency medicine doctor, I have a hard time giving you the best information I can about, you know, how to manage your diabetes or your blood pressure if I don't know what meds you're on, or I can't talk to your primary care doctor, or I don't know what your lifestyle and diet look like. So being able to do those things together is really important. And the same thing was true as a state health officer. It was really hard to make sure that we were getting resources where they need to be, or helping to really create systems that promote wellness, not just address sickness, if you don't have any data on how well people are and what's happening within the state. So this project that I'm working with at Yale has been super fun. It's been an opportunity to really democratize de-identified data. And the idea behind it is to empower individuals, to empower communities, to empower policymakers, and actually journalists, to be able to have a source of data that they can look at to be able to understand, you know, how much RSV is out there, how much flu is happening this year, but also how much diabetes is there, how much hypertension. And we're adding in a lot of other data, such as social determinants of health data, car accident data. There's all these like really fascinating data sets and sources. We're actually launching a measles dashboard probably this week that has not only vaccine rates, but school exemption rates and case counts, both from what's reported within states and then what's reported to CDC. Because each of these data sets, I think of it as like Plato's version of the truth. There's a truth out there, but each of the data sets approximates it. They don't tell you exactly the same thing. And so where they have synergy, where they tell you similar things, that's really important, and where they're different is really important as well. And so, again, my job and what I see both at the state when I work there as an emergency doc and in this space isn't to tell people how to live their life or what the data means, but try to provide the information and then put some context to it to empower people to make the best decisions they can for their lives.
It sounds like a great project. I'm glad I asked. Well, I want to thank my guest, Dr. Ann Zink. She is Alaska's former chief medical officer, the recipient of the 2026 Athena Leadership Award, and also occasional host of Alaska Public Media's Line One. Ann, thanks so much for coming in today.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It's always great to connect.
After this short break, we'll be back with State of Art. I'm your host, Dave Waldron, and you're listening to Hometown Alaska on Alaska Public Media.
Let's hear from another one of this year's Athena Society awardees. Katkin Kilcher Burton served for 31 years in the United States Marine Corps, retiring as a colonel.
The moment I realized I wanted to go into the service when I was about 10 years old is when my brother was drafted for Vietnam. When I joined in 1978, it was for a 3-year commitment. I sometimes tell people that was a long 3 years. I grew up in a log cabin on our family homestead outside of Homer. I went through the exact same physical training, did everything that the men did. Growing up on the Kilcher homestead with 7 siblings, 6 girls and 2 boys, your gender really wasn't an issue. And so it was a good fit for me. Being a woman in the Marine Corps in the late 70s, we were definitely the few, the proud, the women Marines. Our percentage at the time was only 4% of the total Marine force. I started out as a supply officer and went into financial management and then logistics. But early on, I wasn't satisfied with just being a green eyeshade bean counter, as we called them in the Marine Corps. Any exercise or operation, I always volunteered to deploy with the rest of my unit. And so early on, I got a lot of experience in the field doing training. I served in Okinawa in a 3rd Landing Support Battalion, which are the beach and port Marines that help get Marines across the shore. Then I got orders to Marine Corps Recruit Depot, Parris Island, where I was given the opportunity to train female recruits. After that, I was fortunate to have the opportunity to serve as a company commander, as a battalion commander, as well as various logistics and financial management jobs. Being able to mentor and train young women in the Marine Corps was a very rewarding experience. Since I've left the Marine Corps, I returned home to Alaska because I wanted to come home and give back. I've served on various nonprofit boards. I serve as a trustee of the Kilcher Homestead Trust, the Civilian Advisory Board, and I've recently started a nonprofit called Pioneers and Veterans Base Camp in Homer, where we host healing retreats for veterans. Being recognized as part of the Athena Society has been such an honor. And fittingly, I think, of course, is Athena was the goddess of wisdom and war. So that sort of fits in with my journey in life. This nomination and being inducted into the Athena Society to me represents the collective work of many people supporting veterans in Alaska communities and uplifting women in our great state.
That was Katkin Kilcher Burton, retired United States Marine Corps Colonel and a 2026 Athena Society awardee. Thank you.
From Alaska Public Media, this is State of Art. In Alaska. The script was written by ACT's executive director, Matt Fernandez, and is directed by Mary Giles, both of whom join me today. Fernandez says he first found out about Crossan in a newspaper article, but it was working on a theater outreach program with girls that showed him the impact inspiring women like these early aviators could have on someone.
I thought this could be a great opportunity for these girls to just step into somebody else's shoes and try it on. That's kind of the power of acting that acting can do for you. And hopefully the experience will change them for the better. A girl getting to be Amelia Earhart for a couple weeks might do her some good, yeah. Being Marvel Crossan. So that's really where it began.
What would you say Mary brings to the production as a director?
Well, Mary brought us the script to They Promised Her the Moon. We had never heard of that story. And she was actually, I think you were actually slated to direct it, yeah. At one point. Then motherhood got in the way.
Yeah, so I brought you guys, I was on staff at the time, I think, yeah. And I brought the script, They Promised Her the Moon, and you were like, oh, this is great. And I was like, yeah, can I direct it? And he was like, sure. And then I got pregnant, and it was a little too close call to my due date.
And so then, now she's directing it pregnant, by the way.
Right, and so now the stars aligned and I got this chance to direct. I was like, I got to make this happen.
Well, you know, what people have asked me a lot is, because I've directed plays too, is why didn't you direct your play? It's the first time it's being done. Mm. And I thought, oh, maybe I should kind of set a precedent or whatever. But I also, because I'm kind of like learning to be a playwright still. And I don't know if it's like what I want to be known for or whatever. It's just I wanted to write a play. And I thought, you know, I want to be able to write a play that is translatable. And I need to know if it's translatable to other folks who would want to take on and direct it. If I jumped in, I was like, well, I know what this line means or what this scene means, so it's going to be done. And so I thought, let me just try and step back a bit. And I think I did pretty good. Step back a bit and just let somebody else direct it. But I mean, another factor that went into it too, I mean, was I had a couple directors in line, and I thought one of the reasons that we chose Mary too is this is a woman's story, and so perhaps Mary could sort of help that story along. And I mean, I wrote this kind of just like, I wrote this not being a woman.
I help translate that voice, maybe.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I've been around a lot of women my whole life, mothers and things, you know.
A cool aspect that you brought up earlier regarding the cast is what I think's really cool. I always love it when a theater production, the cast is likely probably just completely out of breath by the end of the show because they're doing so much.
It's nuts in this place.
We have 8 women playing 36 different characters. Can we just kind of talk about that a little bit? How is that working? Like, is it, you know, what does that even look like?
Yeah, so during auditions, I don't know, this spring has just been the spring of doing all the productions around town. Like, supply and demand was kind of an issue in terms of actors and production people. And so to get this off the ground, I think you originally had it slated for maybe 17 people playing, yeah, 36 different characters. And
there were men in the cast as well.
Yeah. And during auditions, we're just like, you know, what if we made this all female? What if we made, you know, it's Women's Month or Women's History Month, and it's a show about women. Why not try that? And I like working with small casts because I feel like I get to know people more. Mm. And really connect with people.
Even in spite of maybe them being multiple characters, it's like you still know this actor, you know what they're capable of in these kind of multiple different directions or,
yeah,
something.
And so I did some mental Jenga, and I have spreadsheets upon spreadsheets of like, how can we do this? What characters are on what page? who can have enough time to do a quick change and become a different person?
The script was not written with this model in mind, but we were willing to tweak it. I think there was like at least one time that Mary called me in and is like, can you just come and help us figure out the ending? Because it's crazy. Like,
you I'm picturing a conspiracy board on the wall with all the strings tied to different characters.
Well, there's like one scene, Jade is in the last scene, and then she like disappears and comes back as this other, or as the brother. I'm like, where did Jade even go? Like, how did she? And so the last time I saw it, you know, I had to really watch where Jade goes, because it really is sort of masterful how she, how you have them, like how the attention of the, you know, it was crazy. It's just,
I mean, it sounds like, you know, not only is it like an interesting and inspiring story, it also kind of maybe seems like a feat of stagecraft to accomplish it.
I can't say that enough. Yeah, I mean, feat of stagecraft. We had, we actually built a plane. We had Matt Miller and Bruce Sexauer work on the set, and they actually built us a plane.
Yeah.
Which was like an option in the script. I thought, you know, how are we going to have a plane, you know?
If you can.
So we have a plane with a working propeller.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
Yeah, but I do think I got, maybe gave the costume designer an aneurysm because of all of the different costume changes and how quick they have to be. But what I really love is that during the show, right, the audience members may like see someone who's like, oh, okay, oh, I've seen them before, or oh, she's playing this person now. And then sometimes they're like, wait, is this the same person? Is that who was playing Marvel's mom before? Like, what is... And I love that.
Yeah, totally. That's a trick. Yeah. I mean, how does the cast feel about that? I mean, it sounds like controlled mayhem, maybe, and kind of just... obviously just keeping everything straight, but I mean, is the cast enjoying that aspect of like, oh, now this one, oh, now I'm this person, oh, now I'm this person?
The cast is magical. They they totally rose to the challenge. They were so excited to do that and be that, and they were so happy that it was all women, and it was really like the first read through and we all just clicked, and I was not expecting that. Yeah. But the chemistry of this cast is really something special.
And I know, like, you know, Anchorage theater community, people will kind of, you know, go various places, work together. Was it a fairly new cast in regards to working together for the most part?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I think only a couple of them actually knew each other before the before rehearsal started.
And some of them are pretty new.
Yeah.
Not all of them, but some of them are pretty new at theater.
Yeah, we have a couple that this is their first like actual theater production.
They had done to start with.
I know, yeah. And they are doing great. They're doing awesome work.
Why do you think this story will resonate with the local audience? I mean, obviously the Alaska connection and, you know, a lot of people have, you know, aviation, some kind of related, you know, aspect to their life living in Alaska. But, yeah, what about it do you think will resonate with the local audience? Maybe outside of just the obvious.
That is a great question. I think... yeah, aside from Alaska and aviation and Women's History Month, and the phrase that I just keep coming back to throughout rehearsals, and it's in my director's note, is that women's stories are human stories. And these people had determination and grit, and there's, you know, a bit of talk about sabotage, right? In the second act at the female air derby. And there's this conversation of like, okay, what do we do? How do we navigate this and still keep our integrity and do what we love? And I just think, you know, there are such innate human qualities like determination and grit and
conflict.
Conflict. Yeah. And that's theater for you, right?
Yeah, totally.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's going off what Mary said. I think it's an inspiring story for everybody. You know, it's not just this is a play for women only kind of thing. No, I mean, I find that anybody would be just fascinated. And, you know, I was speaking with Marvel Crossan's niece on the phone yesterday. And I told her, I said, you know what I'm really getting from you about your, you know, because her mother was Marvel Crossan's best friend, as well as her sister, you know. And I said, what I'm really getting from you is your family and all of these people involved in aviation were just a little like crazy adventurous. Like they just took risk. Like this is a sort that this is a specific type of person. And when and it made me think of the second act. I was like, these women are like this breed of person, right? And that just was that wanted to live, like just lived so much, just wanted to live so much that it could, you know, it could actually claim your life. But it's like their quality of life was worth possibly dying for.
The first week of rehearsals, we did table work, and it was just us. Like, I met with each actor individually, and we talked about all their characters. And something that just kept coming up was like, okay, who do you think this woman was? And the word was fearless. These women were just fearless. And to do the things that they did, like Phoebe Amelie was dancing on the wings of planes.
Crazy.
Crazy stuff.
And like some of the aviation technology was not quite as reliable as we have today.
Oh yeah, we're talking like...
yeah. It was only 20 years old.
Like Marvel and Joe built their first plane, like themselves with their parents. Yeah.
Just whip out a plane in the backyard.
Yeah.
I guess to kind of start wrapping stuff up, how has, you know, telling her story... affected you personally, maybe? Kind of like coming out of the other side of this thing, getting so, I guess, just kind of intimately acquainted with Marvel.
You know, the ability to inspire people is what I've taken away. I mean, I don't feel like the play, the script is in a place where I'm ready to stop and just let it be. I'm still working on it. But if I did accomplish one thing, if Mary and I did accomplish one thing together, it was that people left the play saying openly that they want to learn more about this. And that was the original thing for me, was when I learned about the Derby, I learned about these women, I was like, oh my God, I want to share this with everybody. I want everybody to know this. This is great. This is great history. Why didn't we learn about this in school?
That was my conversation with Anchorage Community Theater Executive Director and Playwright of Marvel, Matt Fernandez, and Marvel Director, Mary Giles. I'd give you performance details, but the entire run is sold out. You can find more info at actalaska.org. And that's all for State of Art. I'm Ammon Swenson.
And that's all for our show. Thanks to our guests, Eleanor Andrews and Ann Zink. Ammon Swenson produces this show. You can find us at the Hometown Alaska page on alaskapublic.org, the Alaska Public Media app, or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Dave Waldron, and thanks for listening.
Hometown Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Hometown Alaska's theme song, Lead Dog, is by Kevin Barnett from Eagle River. Learn more about Hometown Alaska and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.